morning and welcome to Rising. Happy Thursday. Love the new hair, Brianna. Looks great.
Thank you. Long overdue post-COVID trim.
Well, I have an update for the viewers because I know they were really concerned about my missing scooters that I haven't been able to find in D.C. No, I found out what's wrong.
What's going on?
The city, this is going to make me very upset, the city rescinded Bird's approval to operate in the city. There is space for 5 scooter companies, and they only approved 4 of them. And they said Bird, even though it was like only 1 point behind on the metrics, I don't know, like quality, sustainability, some nonsense, they kicked them all out. So I am livid. And in fact, there was a local article about the fury online about this that was linking to my tweets. So
I will say that I used to prefer Bird scooters. When I scooted regularly, I did angle for Birds, although that was largely because they were the most available, and I liked that they had a smaller scale scooter that made me feel a little less terrified wheeling through the streets. Mm-hmm. However, there are all of these other brand
options. In full disclosure, I like Bird the best because I've taken advantage of a free promos thing for a long
time.
But...
All right. So you're basically like Steven Crowder, wanting the public to be outraged on your behalf when you have nothing but good.
I wish I had a recorder to play from Home Alone. Like he did. All right, let's get into the actual news of the day. What's going on?
All right, well, according to a financial disclosure filed with the House of Representatives, Paul Pelosi, husband of former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, sold 30,000 shares of Google stock a month prior to the Department of Justice's announcement of an antitrust lawsuit against the tech giant. This is according to Fox News. Here is former Congresswoman and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard on the matter.
These people think that they are special, that they are superior, and that they deserve special treatment that no one else gets. And the sad part, Jesse, is they actually do get this special treatment.
Of course they do.
They actually do get away with this
in the private sector.
This comes after Republican Senator Josh Hawley reintroduced his bill to ban stock trading in Congress, but this time he called it the Pelosi Act, preventing elected leaders from owning securities and investments, which would prohibit members of Congress and their spouses from holding or trading individual stocks and would require members found in violation to return their earnings to the American taxpayer.
Yeah, I can't get over how good that is and how politically smart that is.
Because he worked it out like it makes sense.
Yeah.
And then it condenses well to Pelosi.
100%.
Acronym.
And look, from a political perspective, you know, this is not a cheap shot. There are cheap shots that are thrown around on both sides of the aisle. I mean, I think we're all living out the ridiculousness of pretending that these confidential documents that have been found at it seems everybody's house are the big red herring that Democrats tried to make them out to be when it was just Donald Trump. You know, there are times when people try to dig in and score political points over things that are ultimately just mistakes, and it's boring. This one, Nancy Pelosi, I gotta say, is really the poster child, has really made herself the poster child for insider trading. She has pushed back at every point at which her own party or the other party try to hold her accountable and say we need to pass legislation to try to ban this practice, which is not popular, which the American people don't want them to have access to do, which obviously undermines democracy and creates a conflict of interest between the people who are supposed to be looking out for us and their stock portfolios. And she deserves this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the acronym is fantastic.
I'm glad you brought up the documents thing again. I finally heard someone, and of course it was Mark Levin on Fox News, articulate what I've been thinking. I saw him on Hannity's show last night, and he said, look, it's transparent that this was an attempt to get Trump, but now we know that, like, everyone, like, so many political figures in both parties, this is only the ones we know about. He raised the point, what do you imagine that there are senators with who sat in Intel meetings who have documents in their imagine Dianne Feinstein's garage. Well, how many documents she's perhaps misplaced in there? Or people like, but what I'm saying and what he was saying is that it's not really. It's clear this is an easy mistake to make, and no one has alleged that this is very serious national security documents. But everybody just pretended that this was the gravest insult to the Republic because it was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And they were out to get Donald Trump. And I think that's fair. I think that's very true.
I think it's completely fair. Like, where Democrats were on stronger ground was arguing that Donald Trump was unique insofar as that he wouldn't just give them back. That was his great transgression, not giving them back when asked. And that is meaningful. They were trying to get those documents back from him for the better part of a year. He was obstinate, and that's why Donald Trump got the raid and everybody else just complied. However, they got well over their skis and started talking about how you shouldn't be president of the United States. No one deserves to be president of the United States if you're as irresponsible as Trump was with these documents. And now we're living in this upside-down world where we're all supposed to pretend that didn't happen. But the Pelosi Act, the Pelosi Act is different. Pelosi deserves criticism for every letter of that acronym. That matches up so nicely.
She defiantly, she fought this. She fought this tooth and nail. She was so against attempts to limit members of Congress, political figures, government members from participating in the stock trade. She tried to use the language of, well, we're free market to justify
it,
which doesn't make any sense. And even though this is something that the American people would obviously love, would obviously support, and because time and time again, we've seen that political figures prioritize their stock interest, that when they find out things about COVID, there were two Republican senators who got in trouble for this, finding out about COVID or any things, their first call is to their stockbroker or to their family member who's coordinating with the stockbroker to get around some technical loophole type situation. I mean, it's and then Pelosi, as I pointed out when we talked about this a while ago, it's hilarious. She has stock in Facebook, which she has railed against as this great historic evil, that Mark Zuckerberg is personally responsible for the rise of Donald Trump and thus the rise of fascism.
Yeah, the tech company stuff. I mean, we obviously opened this read talking about her selling these Google shares. Given the enormous implications from a speech perspective and from an antitrust perspective of what's going on with these tech companies, it's incredible that she would wantonly sell these shares around significant congressional happenings and not think that this was going to come down here. And frankly, and I talk about this a little bit at my radar later today in the show, the fact that they continue to do stuff like this speaks to how much impunity Congress members have because we don't have accountability in this country. They never pay at the ballot box for the things they do when they're in office.
Well, here's what Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz had to say about the Pelosi Stock Trading Act on Tim Pool's podcast. Let's listen.
Thinking about, you know, big tech bills and like potentially breaking up Facebook. And just imagine if you're about to even vote on that, and then you go and get put options.
I mean, by the way,
that's
not a hypothetical. That happened. I mean, we had bills that were moving through the Judiciary Committee that passed out of the Judiciary Committee that broke up big tech, and we were all getting ready for them to come to the floor. And on the dip, Paul Pelosi bought a bunch of those stocks.
Wow.
And then guess what? Guess what, Tim? They never f-ing came to the floor.
Wow.
What a surprise.
Now, these people are evil.
What?
Man.
Yeah. I mean, as I was saying, that is an accurate fact pattern there. Draw whatever conclusions you want. And we talked about yesterday, even outside the government, how this can affect policy. We talked about Bill Gates changing attitudes or outlook for various COVID vaccines, et cetera, and how that might have followed his stock selling pattern. And at the very least, American people should know about it.
Yes.
They should know about it when they're deciding who they should elect to represent us and what policies they think those people are going to put in place and whether those policies are serving their interests or corporate interests or their own interests.
Yes. And look, I know that the provocative name of this legislation might scare some of the even more progressive members of the Democratic Party who have articulated a growing affinity for Mama Bear. However, it would be an enormous mistake for the left to let the right lead on this, as it has been leading in so many other issues that used to be core concerns of the left. That's not to say I think that there is a substantial or superior or more good faith interest in these things on the right than the left. But right now, at the end of the day, I mean, despite the left obviously having put forward legislation like this in the past and Nancy Pelosi killing it, I think it would be a really powerful moment if progressives were willing to stand behind a bill as adversarial as something that was called the Pelosi Act and demonstrate that they're willing to fight for principle more than just party leadership.
Here's a question. I wonder what the ratio is for how many stories there are, articles there are about the Pelosi Act in the mainstream media on CNN, MSNBC, New York Times, The Washington Post, versus stories about the life of George Santos. What do you think the ratio is?
Oh, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think it's completely true. Like, I have a hard time. The Santos story is fun. The Sanders story.
It's funny. Absolutely.
But it's not. I mean, I was listening
can't
to
avoid it. We haven't avoided it entirely. We don't. It's not our whole show. We don't spend every day talking about it over and over again, even though it is hilarious.
But honestly, his lies are so much less significant than the average lie that comes out of Congress. I have a hard time getting myself worked up over it. People are like, oh, how are we going to get Santos out of Congress? What are the mechanisms that can get him out of his seat? I mean, if this is what we're doing, if we're trying to get people out of Congress for lying, I got a long list of names that don't start with George or end with Santos.
Yeah, 100%. Well, speaking, though, of Paul Pelosi news, I did see on Twitter that apparently a judge has ordered the release of the footage of the attack. So looking forward to seeing that, and I hope that will, you know, put to rest some of what I thought were just grossly inaccurate mischaracterizations of what we very much, it was an attack on him. But maybe this will, if people are still haven't made up their mind about that or still for some reason think the reporting was not
accurate
enough to show, that will clear that up.
All right. Well, stay tuned. More Rising right after this.
Brianna, what's on your radar?
Well, Robbie, it looks like the elite's contempt for the poor has reached new heights this week. The Lever, first up, reported that billionaires are trying to use the legal system to suppress speech critical of their billionaire campaign spending. As we all know, Citizens United basically enabled the rich to write a blank political check, undermining the principle of one man, one vote by buying elections and even purchasing media outlets in an effort to make their truth the truth. Now they want to make it illegal to even criticize their corruption. Gas mogul Kelsey Warren is suing professional candidate Beto O'Rourke, arguing that he suffered, quote, mental anguish from comments, ads, and social media posts in which O'Rourke suggested that Warren contributed to Governor Greg Abbott's campaign as a reward for Abbott letting Warren's pipeline company off the hook following a deadly storm which left 4 million people without power. The Lever reports that Warren paid Abbott's campaign just 2 weeks after the governor signed legislation that included a loophole, allowing natural gas companies like Warren's to opt out of energy infrastructure winterization mandates that might have prevented the power shutdown. Beto O'Rourke described this as a case of bribery and corruption that resulted in the deaths of Texans, perhaps a reasonable conclusion to draw given the timeline of events. However, Warren apparently wasn't satisfied with just having the power to buy favorable legislation. He wants to silence speech that will call him out for his corrupt behavior. Perhaps not so coincidentally, 4 years ago, Abbott signed legislation that weakened a state law that protected ordinary citizens against defamation suits from wealthy and corporate plaintiffs seeking to silence critics. And this is nothing new. Billionaires have been using these so-called slap lawsuits to intimidate critics for years. For example, in 2017, a West Virginia coal tycoon filed a case against John Oliver and HBO for discussing bad business practices that led to a mine collapse and 9 worker deaths. So much for free speech. Now, when billionaires aren't trying to use the courts to claim permanent victim status for themselves, media figures seem to be doing it for them. In a stunning clip on Fox earlier this week, Sean Hannity went on an unprovoked gushing session about how much better rich people are than poor people. Take a listen.
The years when I needed jobs, and I never got hired by a poor person in my life. I got hired by people that could afford to pay me. Two characteristics. Every wealthy person I've ever met in my life, they have two qualities that are consistent. One is they're smart, and two, they're hardworking.
I don't know who the audience is for this. Sean Hannity has a reported net worth of $300 million. He earns a salary of $40 million from his talk show and podcast and $25 million per year from his Fox News contract. So maybe he's simply forgotten that the average American earns less than $75,000 a year and is a wage earner, not a business owner. Or as failed presidential candidate Mitt Romney once called them, they're takers, not makers. Now, Romney paid the political price for being so dismissive of the hardworking American men and women who bring people like Hannity their dry cleaning, service their cars, shovel their driveways, and deliver their Amazon packages. But apparently, there's some portion of the cable news audience that likes being told that they're not rich because they're dumb and lazy. Or maybe real working people don't actually have time to sit around listening to Hannity in the first place. Listen to him lecture them from his comfortable news desk, gesticulating with his beautiful, smooth, soft hands, not a hair out of place. But look, Hannity's far from the only media elite showing contempt for working people this week. Candace Owens, while discussing the ongoing feud between Steve Crowder and the parent company that hosts both Owens and Crowder shows, argued that multimillionaire Crowder was a socialist because he made demands of his boss. Look, the logic is tortured, but my concern here is not the criticism of Crowder. Have at him. That's between y'all. But about how workers somehow caught astray in all of this. Listen to the contempt with which Candace Owens speaks about workers in this clip.
You don't get to step in like a socialist, and it is socialist-like. These are the demands that you hear, and people are trying to establish a union when the Amazon workers have walked out because they have decided that they are worth more, that they should have three-hour lunch breaks. They've gotten their contract from Amazon, and they realize that their lunch breaks are only 1 hour and that they're required to show up to work, and they think they should be able to work from home for 3 days a week post-COVID, and they walk out, and they want to stage a union, and this is the big con. It's Amazon. No. This is the free markets.
Yeah, Amazon workers, they were protesting because they wanted three-hour lunch breaks and the ability to package packages from home. Sure, that's why they went on strike. Look, a quick reminder. Amazon workers' complaints included that the company's work quotas were so strict that they were forced to pee in bottles to save time. One worker named Christy Schramm documented multiple urinary tract infections caused by holding her bladder for too long. You have to hold your pee or not make your rate, she said. Which one do you want to do? I had to make my rate. Another complaint centered on an Amazon worker who had a seizure on the job due to tough conditions, while another worker died of a heart attack and was then left on the work floor for 20 minutes before receiving treatment. There have also been reports of delivery drivers passing out in triple-digit weather, illegal union-busting activity, and workers wearing diapers in order to compensate for the lack of bathroom breaks. But, you know, we live in a media climate so hostile to labor that Owens, an ostensibly right populist media figure, feels comfortable diminishing the real struggles of ordinary workers, tossing off a comment about how their labor struggle amounts to wanting a bougie three-hour lunch break and the ability to work from home. I'm not sure where she got that. Projection, maybe? I'd hate to hear her take on, say, the railroad labor strike. But don't worry, I did a quick Google, and while I could be wrong, it seems like that wasn't an important enough story for her to ever mention. Not even once. And some positive class war news. There is some bipartisan interest in making Social Security solvent by raising the taxable wage gap. What does that mean? Well, because the rich own our government, they've rigged the system so that they pay much less into Social Security as a proportion of their income than you do. Wages are only taxable for the purposes of Social Security up to about $160,000 a year. So someone making, say, $500,000 or $1 billion is paying the same into the system as someone who's making $160K. This is clearly regressive and puts a disproportionate burden on working people. Even Democratic Party bete noir Joe Manchin is into this plan. Additionally, Republican Senator Bill Cassidy and Independent Senator Angus King have a plan to create an investment fund that would earn profits, which in turn would fund Social Security benefits, would basically capitalize on the higher returns you get from the stock market, and it has the thumbs up from lefty policy wonks like Matt Brunig, as well as bipartisan backing. So what's the rub? Well, this is a radar about how the rich are openly fighting a class war against the poor and working class. But poor and working and middle-class people have been so indoctrinated to admire and protect the rich, to think that they're better than us, that honestly, we often don't fight back, rarely advocating for these types of policies, calling our Congress members or holding them accountable at the polls when they scrap good, common-sense plans like these. What does it mean when media figures that hold the public trust can get away with minimizing labor concerns like wanting the basic right to go to the bathroom as a bourgeois peccadillo, when journalists with over $250 million in assets lecture their middle-class viewers about how much better their class is than yours, and do so with impunity. Liberals do this too, by the way. When the Bernie campaign ended, liberals photoshopped me as a sanitation worker and a fast food employee in an attempt to, I guess, denigrate me, showing instead how little they thought of those hardworking professions. And that's coming from the historical Labor Party, the Democrats. That being the case, it strikes me that a world in which these things happen without consequence is a world where politicians know they can get away with abusing the 99% to their heart's content. And that makes me sad because, controversial take perhaps, the rich aren't actually better than the rest of us. So who's going to tell them? You know, this is an ongoing frustration of mine. It feels like there is this fundamental accountability gap. And when I see the way that poor people are talked about, working class people, middle class people are talked down to by people who literally need working class viewers, middle class viewers to stay rich, to stay in business, it is a real kind of revelation about how much impunity exists among the 1% to treat everybody else like trash.
Yeah, and while I'm sure I would disagree with some of the policies you would recommend to solve this issue, I am interested in what you're talking about with respect to Social Security, which is a huge problem. And Social Security now is designed to be a transfer of wealth from younger people to older people. You know, the idea being at the end of your life, you need
From your younger self to your older self because you're paying into the
system.
Right,
but the issue is we're not putting as much in as people take out at the end. And also, now we live in a society where the elderly are the wealthiest cohort in all of society. Wealth is now concentrated. Obviously, there are poor elderly people as well. There are elderly people who, what can you do with it? You know, they need help. They have no way to support themselves. They need medical care. But on a historical timeline, we have concentrated a lot more wealth in older people. I mean, it's older people have a lot of political power. Yeah. They're literally staffing our government at the highest levels in ways they have not ever before in American history. Whereas young people have had to, you know, try to find jobs during the Great Recession or the COVID economy, or have faced this tremendous economic insecurity and have to pay into Social Security, with a lot of questions about whether they're going to see any of those returns. So I think it's a huge problem where people like me who, you know, don't want to fund a social welfare system if it's going to help already the better off people in society, and people on the left who have maybe want a different version of a social welfare system that is actually taking care of people who need it.
Well, let's not do a category error here. You know, just because older people are wealthier, I mean, there's reasons for that. If you have done what society tells you to do, you've saved, and even, you know, modestly paid people should have a bolus of wealth at the end of their life to live on, you know, for retirement. That's the whole point of saving for retirement. You have been saving your entire life. Of course, you're going to have more money. Moreover, we have all seen all the statistics about how there's these generational shifts where we just don't, our generation has not lived at the same economy as the boomers have lived through, and there are consequences for that. Home ownership as a vehicle for aggregating wealth is completely out the window for our generation. If you bought a house in Brooklyn in 1986, God bless you, you won the lottery, but that doesn't exist for us these days. And we should be clear that, you know, 45% of single retirees rely on Social Security for over 90% of their income. There are huge swaths of the elderly population that, but for Social Security, really would be living in the street, as, you know, Donald Trump warned us about in 2016. And there's a reason why Social Security was such a popular program when it became implemented in the first place. We really did have a situation where we had a class of elderly poor that I think nobody wants to return to. So thank God there are these plans to make Social Security solvent. The question is whether or not there's going to be any genuine appetite for them, despite the fact that they have bipartisan support.
Mm. Well, I certainly don't want to ask younger people to pay even more of their. I mean, it's so much. It's harder for younger people to get started with all the education issues we talk about.
Sure.
All the money you feel like you have to at least take out in order to afford an education to be a viable member of the workforce that they didn't have to deal with 30 years ago or 50 years ago.
Absolutely. But I also don't want to be living on the street when I'm old. We're all old eventually, Robbie, and I don't think that scrapping those kinds of programs for kind of a short-term goals is...
We're all old eventually, but some young people are living on the street too, and others are having a really hard time making ends meet because I feel like there's a generational transfer of wealth taking place.
There's not just a generational transfer of wealth. I mean, that's completely right. There is also an unprecedented concentration of wealth that's happening at the very, very top. You know, I talked about this in a Radar last week, that new Oxfam study that showed that, you know, what was it, 50%, some ungodly amount of all of the new wealth generated in the last 2 years has gone to the top tiny sliver of a fraction of human beings on the planet. And people are working hard. The issue isn't that people aren't earning that money, that productivity isn't, you know, yielding results, is that all of that money is being aggregated at the very, very top in a way that is causing social safety net programs to go insolvent, people to not be able to pay for housing, loans, support their kids, buy eggs. This is a real phenomenon. So I think the issue is not that there's not enough money to go around. It's whether or not we've designed social policy in a way to make sure that only a few people get it. And per my Radar, I think we know why that might be the case, given who's running our government and how much contempt they have for the ordinary American.
Well, I feel like we could keep going at this a little bit, but we have more Rising to bring you right after this. Stay with us. The accounts of former President Trump will be reinstated on Facebook and Instagram in the coming weeks, parent company Meta confirmed on Wednesday. Our determination is that the risk to public safety has sufficiently receded, Meta President of Global Affairs Nick Clegg said in a blog post. As such, we will be reinstating Mr. Trump's Facebook and Instagram accounts in the coming weeks. However, we are doing so with new guardrails in place to deter repeat offenses.
Democratic Representative Adam Schiff hit out at the decision on MSNBC yesterday. Let's watch.
I think Facebook's decision to reinstate Donald Trump is inexplicable. It represents, in my view, a total caving in and copping out. The only motive I can see is a profit motive here. If you look at what Donald Trump has been posting on his own social media platform, all of that violates Facebook's policies. He's continuing to give aid and comfort to those who committed acts of insurrection. He's continuing to spread the big lie. And the idea that somehow he would not do that on Facebook when he's doing it on his own platform, to me, is a tragic decision by a company that is putting its profit above the public interest.
It's inexplicable why Donald Trump should be back on Facebook and these apps. I think free speech is a pretty good explanation.
I think it's explicable.
Like, the idea that he's saying things on other apps that would violate Twitter's policy, therefore he can't come back on Twitter, is ridiculous. You're allowed to say and do whatever you want in the world when you're not in the confines of the social media bubble. Yes. If he gets on Twitter and violates the policy, they can boot him out again.
Imagine thinking the only reason that Facebook would decide to bring back Trump was for their profits. Which, by the way, they are a private company. They want to make profits.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't have to not consider profits because it makes life more difficult for Adam Schiff.
Adam Schiff wants socialism. What the heck? That's what they always say, right?
Yeah, and actually, he should check with his old friend Nancy Pelosi. She wants Facebook to have profits because she was invested in them.
That's true.
But the rationale for taking Trump down in the first place was one I think I understand, although I wasn't totally sold by. You know, what was happening at the Capitol was, in fact, bad. It was bad. I swear it was. It was credibly linked to the things Trump had said, although I would argue not the things he was saying on social media so much as the things he was literally saying to the actual crowd of people that then ransacked the Capitol. Mm-hmm. That was very bad. It wasn't because of some tweets he was making or comments he was making. But, okay, you took him down because there was a actual criminal event taking place that they wanted to get a handle on and put an end to. That was a long time ago that was happening. Like, that active situation is long past over. And to say that he could never be on the platform again when, you know, you can point to all the hypocrisies. Well, why is X dictator still on the platform? Why is X terrorist leader still on the platform? You can't. There's no rational explanation. So I think it's in fact, long overdue to say that he can post on the platform again.
Also, look at the revolving door of people who have been brought back from the ashes already. Just because he comes back to the platform doesn't mean he's going to behave well enough to stay. We just talked about how Nick Fuentes was back for, what, all of 24 hours, if that, before he was kicked back off the app. Kanye West brought back, I feel like he's been back more times than a phoenix, keeps getting kicked off for violating the policy, or maybe not violating the policy. There's some discussion about whether or not Elon Musk is actually administering the policy in a transparent and consistent way versus just kind of kicking people back off once they embarrass him. Either way, just because Donald Trump is acting poorly in other places, just because it might be likely that he violates again, doesn't mean that there shouldn't be an opportunity for him to come back.
Well, and with Hunter Biden, they had to kind of come up with an explanation for why this was violating a policy. It was a very vague explanation for what precisely he was violating, because they allowed him to say things that were incorrect, and then they would fact check him and they'd say this is incorrect, this statement about the election or whatever it is, but it's in the public interest to leave it up. They would do that, but then they decided what was happening at the Capitol made that no longer tenable. But again, it wasn't because he was tweeting attack the Capitol.
Right. The Twitter
he
files
was tweeting. I'm not going to go to the inauguration. That was the bridge too far.
I think there was one tweet, and I don't remember what it was now. That was, I think, more plausibly an incitement. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, one core tweet that I really think think that justified at least temporarily suspending Donald Trump. But unless the policy is permanent ban, we're talking about, like,
honestly, the thing I thought he tweeted that was like closest to being over the line had nothing to do with any of this, which was when he's very, very much like explicitly suggested that Joe Scarborough had killed his assistant or something. Do you remember that whole thing?
No. I mean, I remember the Joe Scarborough scandal, but not Trump's read on it.
Right, which is like verging on a libelous claim.
Yeah.
Especially for conservatives who are all, we've got to make defamation law stronger now because the media gets to lie about everything. Well, that
or
means
for
your
Reiter,
own.
We got to make defamation law stronger so you can't complain about our corporate malpractice.
Right. I don't want to make defamation law stronger at all. I think it would be self-defeating. And one of the examples of being self-defeating is right-wing people like Trump just kind of saying whatever BS. You could think under a climate of free speech, it's healthy to allow people to do that, even if they're going to say a lot of things that are exaggerated or wrong. But some conservatives want to draw that line a lot closer, and I don't think it would be to their own.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Down a rabbit hole.
When
a
you see
bit,
people, but. No, that's important though. When you see billionaires trying to up the ante with defamation law to insulate themselves against political criticism. Mm-hmm. Political candidates can't say, hey, there's corruption there. Oh, that person's buying an election. You can't say that anymore because billionaires have made defamation law so that we're fighting these defamation cases so expensive and so onerous, and they know they have the money to win. That is a significant, significant speech problem. But let me ask you this, Robbie. We live in a very different Twitter world, a different Twitter landscape than the one that existed when Donald Trump was first kicked off the app. I got to say, many people haven't missed him as much as they thought. The void that he left seems to have been filled by other actors. It seems that Elon Musk is now the main character on Twitter every day, not Donald Trump. Is there enough room in this town for the both of them?
It's a good question, especially when you think about the Facebook context. Charlie Warzel, who writes for The Atlantic about tech issues, who I usually disagree with, respectfully disagree with, he had a great post in The Atlantic yesterday about how Trump and Facebook resemble each other a little bit in that their relevance is fading.
Oh, I saw that.
And it's a very good point. You know, if you flash back to 2016, Facebook is the news delivery system, right? That's in fact, if you're writing, if you're a journalist, if you're producing content, you want it to pop on Facebook. That is the delivery mechanism to your audience. Trump skillfully using Facebook. He wins the election. Facebook is actually accused of causing the whole thing and being compromised by Russia in a lot of ways that was like so wildly exaggerated, if not flat out wrong. But that was yesterday. Today is so different. And I don't think Facebook will ever again have that kind of a command over the news cycle, in part because choices it made to itself. They deprioritize news. Like I've described this whole, like right now the tech sector is laying off a lot of people and media is laying off a lot of people. This was a murder-suicide. The tech started this.
Yeah.
They decided news is too scary. I mean, it goes around in circles because the media accused tech of spreading too much fake news. So then tech deprioritized news. So then when news got deprioritized, fewer people were reading. It killed their profits. They had to fire people.
Right.
And then tech found, well, now there's no content because there's no more news, so we have to fire people.
Well, the other piece that we learned about that from the Twitter files is that it's politicians that are pressuring media to write articles that threaten the tech companies, and it's round and round and round we go. And everybody's suffering as a consequence. And I do have some fear, and I want to know what you think. Are some of the changes that Elon Musk is making into Twitter going to similarly kill that app's power from being so important to journalists, to being so important to politics, being, you know, the place where you come for the news cycle? The fact of keeping Trump off the app, is that kind of an exemplification of the kind of policy choices that are pushing Twitter farther and farther into irrelevance, the way that Facebook is now? I mean, when do I log on to Facebook? To double check a friend's birthday?
I almost never post on Facebook. I wonder when the last time I posted an article or a video on Facebook. It's got to be over a year ago.
I had the auto post from my Instagram stories to my podcast account, but that's truly it.
It'll be like Napoleon returning from Elba, a very exciting 100 days, and then back to exile.
I hope it is. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say I hope it is exciting. I'm obviously not wishing for anything that is illegal or bad or harmful to happen. But I've got to say, there is something about the way that the media is framing Donald Trump and his run that doesn't quite sit well with me. And I think they're able to control, because it doesn't seem accurate. I think they're able to control the narrative and kind of manifest realities about his campaign, in part because he is marginalized in this way on these social media apps. And it will be interesting to see whether the journalists themselves have learned the lesson of 2016 and realized that just because Trump's back doesn't mean they have to talk about him. Yeah. I never used to even follow
Trump. He could prove this is not out of the realm of possibility whatsoever. I mean, he's starting to be almost underrated slightly.
Yes.
He could come out of you know, semi-exile and quickly suck up the news cycle again, knock Ron DeSantis out of the running, and be the Republican nominee for president again. Like, that could happen. That's starting to be counted out as unlikely. I think it's not the most likely outcome, but it is not impossible. Like, don't pretend
I did a radar on this, just in case. Yeah. I did put my finger on the page just as a bookmark to see if we can come back to this. But look, the alternative is that being kept off of Twitter and Facebook is the best thing that could have ever happened to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's keeping him in this game and making him seem more tolerable to folks who just wanted civility. And that Ron DeSantis knows what he's doing in not being a Facebook warrior and basically outsourcing a lot of his worst statements to his media consigliaries.
Well, before we go, some interesting Trump news. I just saw this on Twitter from the Palm Beach Post. So Trump won a golf tournament at Mar-a-Lago, to the Trump International Golf Club, in West Palm Beach. But he won the tournament. He missed the first day of the tournament because he was attending the Diamond and Silk funeral. Mm-hmm. But so when he showed up for the second day of the tournament, but he was in the lead, he's like, oh, that's because I played a round of golf on another day before I went to the funeral, and I did really well, and this was my score. Isn't that funny?
He's rigging golf games?
Trump told tournament organizers he played a strong round on the course Thursday, 2 days before the tournament started, and decided that would count as his Saturday score for the club championship. That score was 5 points better than any competitor posted during Saturday's first round. He announced on True Social that he won the senior club championship.
Oh, my gosh. The emperor has no clothes. You almost got to respect the game.
A winner is Trump. More Rising right after this.
The defense attorney representing Idaho murder suspect Brian Koberger represented Zana Kernodle's mother on several drug-related charges before recusing herself from Kara Kernodle's most recent case in an unexpected turn of events. News Nation's Ashley Banfield spoke exclusively with Kara last night. Let's watch some of that.
I'm heartbroken because I trusted her. She pretended that she was wanting to help me and to find that out, that she's representing him, I can't even convey how betrayed I feel.
Have you had a chance to speak with her about this?
No. No, I haven't spoken with her. I found out through a friend who found it on Reddit.
We're joined by senior national correspondent at News Nation, Brian Enten, who's here to fill us in on this and more developments in the quadruple Idaho murder case. Brian, walk us through what we've learned. I know there's been a lot of updates on how much content or contact, at least one directional contact between Koberger and the victims, that he had been in their DMs on Instagram, although maybe they hadn't seen them, and now this attorney wrinkle. Update us.
Yeah, the attorney situation is interesting. Basically, Zanna Kernodle's mom, who you just saw there, who has had a history, which she talks about, of, you know, drug issues and has been in and out of jail and been arrested several times, had Ann Taylor, the public defender, as her lawyer. And you know, it was apparently like they knew each other. They met many times. Zanna's mom claims that Ann Taylor had power of attorney over her to help her get into rehab at one point. So it was sort of an extensive relationship. And Ann Taylor is now the public defender for Brian Koberger, which is just like kind of weird to wrap your mind around. So one of the victim's mom's public defender is now the public defender for the man accused of killing that woman, Zanna, that young woman. Zanna's mom is not happy about it. Basically, the lawyer got off of her case so that she could take on Brian Koberger's case, which really has that family not happy.
Well, because the implication is also, I mean, you would think that given that she had a previous relationship representing the mother, she would recuse herself from the murder case and keep representing the mother in her drug cases. It seems insult to injury to choose instead to represent the murderer. Do we know about whether or not the attorney had a choice in which of those cases she recused herself from?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and we don't know, and we're hoping to find out, but it's difficult because of this really strict gag order right now involving the case. Like, the lawyers aren't allowed to talk at all, which in a way sort of puts her in an unfair position because she can't really respond to any of this, and we don't really know what happened behind the scenes. But we do know, you know, there's not a lot of public defenders in Idaho, and there's not a lot that are death penalty certified in that area. So it would make sense for Ann Taylor to be on the Koberger case because she is death penalty certified and has the experience to handle the case. Mm-hmm. But it's still really perplexing that this wouldn't be a conflict, especially like, you know, if there's trial and Zanna's mom has to testify, mm-hmm. like how could Zanna's mom's former lawyer, you know, interview her on the witness stand? I think it's going to bring up all sorts of possible issues.
Yes, that was my question. So it sounds like this may have come about because of the geographic proximity. He's going to be tried in a certain place where she'd be the person you might call to say he needs a public defender, rather than her, like, you know, calling up and saying, I'm going to represent this guy who's halfway across the country. It's a where it's taking place sort of component to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what it appears in one way. Again, we don't really have the public defender's side because she's not allowed to talk. So it does appear that there's limited resources in Idaho, especially when it would come to a mm-hmm. death penalty case. But we don't really know how they're going to work around some of these issues now that she has this relationship with Zanna's mom.
So tell us more about what we've learned with respect to contact, virtual contact, at least on social media, and anything else about the murderer, the alleged murderer, and the victims.
Yeah. So again, with the gag order, we haven't gotten a ton of information. People magazine reported that Koberger had direct messaged one of the victims through Instagram. I didn't say which victim that was, but that it may have gone into the unread folder. You know, like if you get a message from someone you don't follow, it goes into a separate folder and may not have been noticed by one of the victims. We haven't been able to get that reporting on our own. You know, I've been really careful with the social media aspect just because when we first got the name Koberger a little bit before it was released, I couldn't find really any social media for him. And then when the name came out, like literally within hours, there were all of these accounts that were apparently created by fake people. So I think with the social media element, like we just have to be careful and wait just because there's a lot of people online that have sort of just like created these fake Brian Koberger accounts.
There was some reporting earlier on that one of the victims believed that they had been stalked, was overheard talking in a shop about having a stalker. Do we know if there was any connection between the alleged perpetrator here and her belief that she was being tracked in that way?
Yeah, we don't know. And that was actually my reporting. We interviewed a vape shop manager who had interacted with the victims and Kaylee Gonzalez quite a number of times and heard them talk about this possible stalker who was following Kaylee. We haven't seen anything that specifically connects that to Brian Koberger, but, you know, in the arrest affidavit, there is all of this evidence and cell phone data that shows that police believe Koberger was around the house many, many times before the killing, sort of driving around. So it wouldn't surprise me if he was in fact following them around. But we haven't seen anything come out from police to actually connect him to like following. I mean, he was circling the house, they say, but we don't know that he was like following them, you know, on campus or around downtown or anything like that.
Well, I also saw a report that he may have dined at a restaurant where Zaina and Madison worked, and there's a possibility they would have waited on him.
Yeah, this was another report that came out that he went there to, you know, he was vegan and that they had a vegan menu on the item and that he went to the Mad Greek restaurant, which is where some of the victims worked. But interestingly, again, that wasn't my reporting, so I can't talk too much about it. But the restaurant has now come out and said that that is not true, that it was a former employee who said that, and that it's definitely not true that they apparently looked at the video. So, you know, we don't really know for sure if that happened.
It seems like, you know, obviously this is a huge national story, and based on what you just said, people who live in the town are kind of weighing in and potentially trying to become a part of that story. Can you help us get a sense of what the public reaction has been locally now that there is a suspect in hand, what the atmosphere is like on campus in particular?
Yeah, I think there's definitely relief overall. The minute the arrest happened, you could just feel it in the town. So things definitely feel calmer there. I think the students feel safer walking around. But in terms of like some of these reports and you know, the leaks that continue to come out, I think there's a little bit of frustration in the town. Like they just kind of want to be left alone a little bit right now, which I can totally get. I mean, we were camped out there for so long. And you know, there's this preliminary hearing that's set for June, which we will get a lot more information then. And I think the town, the people who live there, they're just hoping, like, can everybody just give us a break right now? Because, you know, everybody is covering the story nationally, obviously, and really into it. But for the people who live there, it's like, you know, this is their town. And they're not used to this kind of attention.
Yeah. For sure. Is there anything else that you think being there, talking to people, following this more closely than, you know, perhaps anybody else really in the country, that you think people should know about this case? And generally speaking, being on a kind of a crime beat, are there things that are still surprising you about this particular crime as compared to others that you might have covered?
Yeah, I mean, I think the gag order is really surprising. I've never really seen anything quite like it. I mean, I've seen gag orders before, but it's gotten stricter and stricter. That's something we haven't talked about yet. You know, the judge had a gag order initially saying that none of the lawyers could talk, or the prosecution or defense or law enforcement, and then put out a new gag order saying not only can the lawyers not talk, but people representing the victims and basically anyone connected to the case can't talk. Which I've never seen anything like that. There's this media coalition now that plans to fight that, because now they're trying to silence people who, you know, aren't even like lawyers in the courtroom, which is a little bit unheard of, I think. So that's surprising to me, and I think it'll be interesting to see the way that plays out.
Well, is there any justification given for why there's these gag orders in place?
I think that they're just hoping they really want a fair trial, which I think most people can understand. And they want to have a very tight case where, you know, there's no reason that someone can come back and say, oh, this got leaked or that got leaked, and that's the reason that this shouldn't move forward. So in some ways, I think the intentions seem good. But, you know, I think there's just questions about how far can a judge really go to keep everybody totally silent. And in some ways, I think it fuels leaks, like you're hearing about some of these things coming out. I think has the court, you know, angry. I think that's actually why they pushed forward and made the gag order even more serious, like even more strict.
Yeah, I was wondering if there were some maybe jury selection implications, given that it's a smaller pool, and it's such a big story. But regardless, thank you so much for all of your reporting on this.
Yeah, thank you for having me again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we'll have to keep following the story, and we'll have more Rising for you right after this.
The conservative outlet Newsmax has been dropped from DirecTV's channel lineup, despite pleas from House Republicans who said the action would impact their ability to reach constituents. DirecTV said the decision came down to Newsmax asking for rate increases, which, quote, would have led to significantly higher costs that we would have to pass on to our broad customer base, according to the Daily Beast.
Freshman Representative Wesley Hunt said that the TV provider's inability to come to an agreement with Newsmax over fees embodies, quote, a political decision to censor conservative media, which is a red flag for the First Amendment. According to the Daily Beast, anyone, including DirecTV customers, can watch the network for free on NewsmaxTV.com, YouTube, and other streaming platforms. DirecTV Stream customers can still watch Newsmax programming for free on the app. So what do you make of this? Is there any evidence that they did ask for, you know, an serious level of rate increases that are kind of outside of industry norm that would justify this kind of a move?
I don't know a lot about that. What I do know is that there could be something very nefarious going on here because, in fact, as with the Twitter files, as with the Facebook files, there was pressure on AT&T, which is the parent company of DirecTV, to drop Newsmax coming from Democratic politicians. I wrote about this a couple months ago, maybe a year ago. Yeah, here it is. This was February 2021. I wrote this about a letter sent from Representatives Anna Eshoo and Jerry McNinerney, who are both California Democrats, who sent a letter to AT&T saying that Newsmax and One America and some other channels, they're spreading misinformation. Mm-hmm. So you're culpable. You know, it's one of these letters that are with very leading questions like, we would like you to answer these questions. What moral or ethical principles do you apply in deciding which channels to carry? Do you require the channels you carry abide by content guidelines? It's this very aggressive kind of, maybe do something about this, or we're going to take a look at your business practices that we've seen time and time again. So, look, obviously, Newsmax doesn't have some right to be carried by DirecTV and AT&T. If the company looks at its numbers and says, yeah, this isn't making us money, this costs us money, their fee is unreasonable, we're just not going to do it, yeah, that's fine. That happens in business all the time, and sometimes conservatives miss that a little bit and shouldn't miss it as the people who supposedly believe in free markets.
It's a profit motive, right? Until it's not, yeah.
Sometimes that's just the way it goes. You don't get to compel a company to do business with you for the First Amendment doesn't, that's not how it works. It's the opposite of that.
Correct.
The company doesn't have to engage with you because it has First Amendment rights and various other rights. But all that said, we know these pressure campaigns are real. We have seen them at work, and it is clear as day that there was one taking place here. That was, again, so it's not so much in my view that what AT&T is doing is necessarily wrong. It was wrong of anyone in government who told them that that jawboned them. That's the term I used in my radar from the other day, that it tried to persuade them to take this action, which it very much looks like the Democratic Party did.
Well, look, I think that there is
The Daily Beast wants to, you know, criticize Republicans for being upset about it, but they're responding to they're trying to push back against the push that the Democrats initiated. So it's of course the mainstream media would focus on, oh, and Republicans are getting themselves involved.
Yeah,
well, they're criticizing what Democrats did to get us to this place.
So there are a couple of pieces here. I think that what you say about the plausibility of this being the effect of a pressure campaign is certainly there. It's certainly plausible because we know that there has been a pressure campaign. In fact, we have seen other instances in which media companies, tech companies have sort of bent the knee to political pressure with the Parler and these apps getting taken off of Apple, the App Store, and all of these other kinds of things. We certainly know that these kinds of pressures can result in kind of censorship or deplatforming of entire media channels, et cetera. I think the missing piece that we really need to know, and this is actually giving me kind of Steve Crowder flashbacks, is whether or not there is any evidence that the negotiations here were really the cause, even if there was a pressure campaign, were they the cause of the Newsmax deal being declined? So are we going to have more transparency than has existed in this kind of Steve Crowder scenario, where they give evidence showing that this is what the rate was that was demanded, and then perhaps temperatures will cool? They wanted something that was outside of market norms. It wasn't profitable for us. They can easily substantiate that if it comes to this. But there's also this kind of bigger question of, even if we think that this is a pressure campaign that was wrong in this instance, are there legitimate concerns about not just Newsmax, but all kinds of television outlets, including liberal left-leaning ones, that have not held up to the kind of standards of news journalism that we remember from yesteryear kind of fondly when we talk about Walter Cronkite and all of that? And should we be having a conversation about the fairness doctrine and what happened when there weren't some kind of neutral guidelines about how these news channels should carry news that is engaging with different sides of the political spectrum? We value that so much on this show that we have built into the design of the program that there are opportunities to engage with contrary views. You sit there, I sit here every day, and it's why it works. It used to be the case that there were more requirements on mainstream cable news shows to have those two differences of opinions built into the structure of the show. And is that something that we should be looking towards so we don't have to rely or that not we don't have to rely on, but that these elected officials don't feel compelled to basically make their own little personal case about whatever little bit of the news they happen not to like?
That's an interesting point to bring up. I don't think in today's day and age, mandated neutrality or mandated fairness could possibly work, because who is deciding what counts as a balanced perspective or a counter perspective? Like, is that a regulatory commission? Is that... I don't think those people could be trusted whatsoever to get that right. Frankly, I also think if the Supreme Court got to weigh in on it, they would then say, well, then you're violating the First Amendment by requiring neutrality. You don't have the right to do that.
So just to be clear, though, it's not mandated neutrality. Neutrality wasn't the issue. The Fairness Doctrine had two basic elements. I'm reading this now. It required broadcasters to devote some of their airtime to discussing controversial matters of public interest, so the determination of what is public interest, which is subjective for sure, but and to air contrasting views regarding those matters. So not that you need to get some like neoliberal never Trump Republican who, as we've discussed, is the exact same thing as a vote blue no matter who Democrat,
right?
You know, but that you have people that whatever they think two different things, and at very least viewers are getting a mix. And it's hard for me to see how that could be worse than what we're getting now.
I think that could be worse. I think in an ideal world that sounds nice.
You don't think it'd be better if Joyanne Reed were forced to have a real, actual Republican on?
But Joyanne Reed type Republicans will be the ones deciding what is the counter perspective.
Well, not
that would be my.
It wouldn't
issue.
Be. It's not up to the broadcasters themselves to self police.
No, it would be up to the deep state. It would be up to the regulatory commission.
But here's the thing,
which is going to be staffed by people approved by
them. I understand, but right now we have this kind of vigilante effort on the part of random Democratic officials to basically pursue the same ends, potentially successfully in this case. So do you want it to be this ad hoc process where liberals are using their authority with tech to basically get their way, which we don't know that that's what happened here, but could be what happened here, or an accountable, democratically appointed body that has hearings and transparency that is making decisions, not about content, but at least saying, hey, you need to have some ideological diversity in here so we don't just have another panel of, you know, Whoopi Goldberg types populating MSNBC.
I think the very people applying the pressure campaign would be the ones staffing the body you're talking about or picking the people on it.
Why do you say that? We have a Republican-controlled House now. They've made all kinds of interesting moves that I think are really meaningful.
I mean, to be clear, I don't want Republicans approving the content that's going to be on these networks either. But
honestly, I got to say, I'm no Republican, I'm no conservative, but I 100% believe that MSNBC would be a better experience if Josh Hawley were weighing in on the composition of some of the panels that they have on that programming. Does that not make you think, oh, maybe I'll actually turn on MSNBC? Think there's actually going to be a debate between people who have sincerely held beliefs and not just like former deep state operatives that are sitting there opining on whether we should send more weapons.
I do. I don't agree that what you're laying out leads to that happening. I think it leads to actually more.
Maybe, deep state operatives. But you know, it seems like something needs to change in the status quo.
in the meantime, what absolutely needs to change is that members of Congress have to stop doing this. I hope they're punished at the ballot box. I mean, that's maybe a naive hope. I hope companies start telling them, you know, to go to HE double hockey sticks for trying to. I mean, this letter is nuts. I remember talking about it or writing about it, being very furious. Have you ever taken any actions against a channel? This is the letter to DirecTV, for using your platform to disseminate any disinformation. If yes, please describe each action and when it was taken. It's like a freaking homework assignment. Like, what gives you the right?
Yeah, I mean, I will say this also.
I hate this.
Conservative
stuff.
News has been so much more popular than liberal news of late. And so there is a part of me that believes we are living in a deeply capitalist country where profit is king, that would be surprised if there weren't some financial aspect to this that is legitimate. Whereas, you know, Fox News is the biggest moneymaker in television. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to believe that if Newsmax were really so profitable and good for DirecTV, that DirecTV wouldn't pony up and give them the money. There's a reason why Steven Crowder feels like he can demand $50 million, a $50 million contract or what have you. It's like these shows are actually making money. So it suggests to me that maybe there is a there to DirecTV saying they were asking for more than was profitable. But again, that's something that can be
But as with the social media company, you know, they, Facebook, et cetera, they started taking a much more heavy moderation against content that was highly engaged with, including Donald Trump's account, including COVID stuff, because they got really convinced by Democratic political figures who are doing messaging to them and government bureaucrats, et cetera, that they were going to be held accountable for the harm to society and that was going to hurt their... It's not that they decided, oh, but we're harming society. They said, this is going to be worse for us because our liability is going to be get tweaked or we're going to have antitrust coming in. Or so it's still... They're still thinking about their profit motives.
Yes, but they felt like... I mean, that's kind of a lose-lose scenario.
Yes.
And I'm not... And it's not entirely clear to me that that's the dynamic that's emerging on these cable news networks, but we'll see.
Again, my guess would be yes, but you're right. We would need to know more about
it. Crowder style, you can just have some transparency and it changes the story. The news coming out that Steve Crowder actually was so upset over being a wage slave for only getting $50 million really changed the narrative here. And if DirecTV wants to defend itself, I'm sure it can make the terms of the contract available to the public.
All right, we'll have more Rising right after this. Stay with us.
You're willing to overlook some awful on your side, and you're willing to exaggerate some on the other side. But everybody's on the same team, so you have to pretend. These people lighting churches on fire aren't. These people lighting schools on fire and lighting courthouses on fire. The mostly peaceful. Oh, it's mostly peaceful, Adam
Burning
Curry.
In the background.
I saw someone again say this because of what happened in Atlanta.
Yeah, the Cop City thing.
Yeah, and they were calling
this
thing.
There was literally a cop car on fire.
Anyway, they were calling it mostly peaceful.
In CNN's backyard.
You
I know,
can't
it was fantastic.
You're not the propaganda department. You can't define things in a way to calm people down. That's not what your job is.
That was podcast giant Joe Rogan blasting the media, namely CNN, yesterday when he went on a rant about how media outlets act as the propaganda department for their ideological allies. The context here is Atlanta police arrested six suspects on domestic terrorism charges in connection with an anti-police riot over the weekend, protesting the building of a police facility in a wooded area of the city, Cop City, a $90 million facility.
Protesters in Atlanta were purportedly angry about the death of activist Manuel Esteban Pais Terán, or Tortuguita. He was killed by police after he allegedly, according to them, refused demands from the authorities and allegedly fired a gun at state troopers while protesting the facility. We talked about this yesterday with Marianne Williamson. I know both you and her, who followed this more closely than I have a lot of questions about that encounter, which was not recorded and was supposed to be recorded. Without knowing more about it, I would not inherently take the police word necessarily for how this went down. But Marianne described this as very out of character for the activist. I probably also object to that kind of facility being built on taxpayer dime to make police more militaristic. Police need more training in how to defuse situations without loss of life, not in how to operate tactical gear or execute SWAT team raids. So I agree with you guys on all of that stuff. I probably agree, at least in part, with Rogan on the questions of the riots turning, if not violent, destructive. Things being set on fire, windows being smashed. These are never tactics that I approve of, no matter who does them. I think they're bad ideas in and of themselves because you shouldn't smash other people's stuff, and also because in my view. I know there's a lot of conflicting research on this, but I think they tend to draw negative attention to causes or causes that might otherwise be worthwhile to become associated with lawlessness and violence, which then shuns moderate people you want to attract to the cause. But what's your view?
So I am going to have a bit of a hot take here, which is that I don't believe those kinds of protest actions are always unjustified. Mm-hmm. I think that history reflects on the victors and decides what was justified and what's not, what is considered to be a riot and what is considered to be the start of the Revolutionary War, for instance. And these things happen in retrospect. I think that the riot is the language of the unheard and that there's something kind of fundamentally problematic about pretending as though these things happen as random acts of lawlessness or because someone just really has it out for a CVS window or something, as opposed to being a response to a repeated behavior by the police department that isn't being addressed through any political means. I would also say that the same, to be clear, of the 1-6 protesters. I have argued recently on my show and elsewhere that there has to be consistency when we look at how the criminal justice system is treating protesters, many of whom were egged on and encouraged by the President of the United States and thought that they weren't going to be culpable or promised that this by elected leaders that they were justified in believing that the election was stolen and that they were doing something patriotic and good when they entered the Capitol and tried to stop the count. So, that being said.
But what are you saying is the hypocrisy?
When you're saying
it's important to prosecute the 1-6 people with whatever same levels, or are you saying that happening?
Yeah,
they're throwing the book at those people.
I would
people.
Be more lenient with both, to be honest, is what I'm saying. And I think that most people. Here's where I agree with Joe Rogan here, and that most people would not consistently have the same position to those groups of people, maybe because they think they're meaningfully ideologically different. I definitely think they're meaningfully ideologically different. But I have a tough time with the fetishization of this kind of anti-protest action, the fetishization of property that comes through some of these things when there's no similar fetishization or emphasis on the lives lost or the substantive grievances that people have in these moments. Now, I also agree with Joe Rogan when he says that there is a certain degree to which liberal outlets pretended like everything was completely nonviolent. I do think it's true that the protests were mostly nonviolent. I think that's an accurate statement. There were 20 million people in the streets. Right. Most of them weren't violent.
That's technically true
obviously.
About the 1-6 protests as well. There were thousands and thousands of people 100%. There. 99% of them, 95% of them
Absolutely.
Did nothing wrong except exercise their First Amendment
Absolutely.
Rights.
So I think that Rogan is wrong to say you can't say that it was mostly nonviolent. Of course it's true. But I think you can also recognize that there is violence. Like, of course you can recognize that things were set on fire. A police station was burned down. And frankly, public polls after the police station was burned down, were in favor of the protesters because public sentiment was such that no one wanted to be a fan of the police. We all saw a human being murdered on camera, screaming, crying out for his life, saying that, he couldn't breathe, and he was killed with impunity. And people at the time believed that a building was a perfectly good exchange for a human life. In fact, it wasn't enough, right? So, look.
But it doesn't bring the person back. To set the car
no,
on fire.
No, nothing does.
Or to smash the windows.
The point I'm arguing is that I agree with Joe Rogan that there is sometimes a failure to acknowledge that there is violence. But my issue would be, yes, there's violence, but I don't necessarily think that it's not politically warranted. And history is the one that tells you whether or not the thing that you did was considered to be a riot or looting or whatever it is, or whether or not it's considered to be the Boston Tea Party and the start of a Revolutionary War that was the beginning of a great nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're pretty far apart on this one. I agree with you that there's a lot of hypocrisy on both sides with who gets characterized as violent protesters and who gets, you know, conservative media saying these are patriots fighting for our rights, these are Antifa terrorists, or on the other way, the mainstream media saying these are, you know, fascist Nazis and these are people fighting for racial
justice.
By
the way, I don't know that we actually know who started the church at Lafayette Square. There was a Proud Boy leader that took credit for burning down the Black Lives Matter church flag at one of these events. So even there's some mixed messaging there for Rogan.
Sure, but they've thrown the book at those people.
Yeah,
Proud Boys,
I don't agree with that. I do agree with it, frankly.
I don't want to live in a society where windows are smashed and things are set on fire and those people are not held accountable. I want those people to go to jail. I do.
I don't think you should be getting a multi-year jail term.
Well, you should get a jail term that's consistent with the crime you commit. Yes. I don't think you should be locked in solitary confinement. I don't want to lock people in solitary confinement regardless of what their crime is.
Let me see. This came up in that the 1/6 documentary. I forget exactly how long he was sentenced for, but I remember hearing it. Okay, so more than 5 months in jail. He was sentenced to more than 5 months in jail for burning a flag. I thought the whole point, as a leftist,
I don't think should be a crime.
That's
it's
outrageous.
Not a crime, in fact. The Supreme Court has
said repeatedly. Well, it wasn't an American. It was a Black Lives Matter flag, so it's not even about whether or not it's not like flag burning.
Well, burning somebody else's flag.
Burning someone else's property is the issue here. It's not the fact that it's a flag of something immaterial.
I don't think you should set other people's property on fire.
When I think about what it means to be incarcerated, when I think about what our jail conditions are like, when I think about what that means for families who are perhaps without a income provider for 5 months and all the downstream economic effects that the state's going to have to pay for anyway, it strikes me as punitive. As much as I hate that this Proud Boy person who may or may not be a white supremacist or whatever burned a Black Lives Matter flag, this is not about my ideological desires.
Here's a hot take for you as well. A very hot take. I might say it's a little bit different if the destruction, depending on who it's, I don't know that you would draw this distinction, but like setting the police car on fire in response to something the police did that was bad might be more justified or legitimate than smashing the windows of CVS. CVS didn't do anything to you. The police did. If it's concentrated on the actual aggressors of the violence, make some philosophical defense
for it. Robbie is coming out in favor of burning down that, what was it, Minnesota police precinct?
Yeah, but not. But you got to leave the CVSs alone. You can't smash random people's storefronts. If you concentrate your fire on the police itself, they're the ones you say you're mad at.
Sure, I'll go police, big box retail store, mom and pop.
All right, well, I think we could discuss this much longer, but they're telling us we got to wrap. We'll have more Rising right after this.
New York Mayor Eric Adams announced this week that he will be implementing a new program so that New Yorkers can hear news and announcements directly from him instead of getting a, quote, distorted version from the media. And New York City taxpayers get to pay for it. Lucky them.
This comes as Adams' tough-on-crime approach faces mounting scrutiny. For example, the city's subway crime rose by 30% in 2022 from a year ago, outpacing the 22% jump in major crime across the city during the same period. This is according to police data released this week. The increase comes despite the deployment of thousands of additional police patrols in the transit system.
All right. Eric Adams won on big promises to fund the police harder and staff the subway up with a policeman on every car. He has done that, and crime has gone up, not just compared to the crime rates in New York City, but compared to national rates. What's the answer, Robbie? Do we just throw more money at the police and also give the mayor a direct line to the public's ears so that he can do his own propaganda campaign?
It sounds like you're going to be the very first subscriber to the Daily Adams. All Eric Adams news, all Eric Adams time.
I'm such a masochist. I probably would listen to it the same way that I listen to so many liberal shows for content.
Sounds very cringy. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously cringy look for political figures to want to, I mean, political figures disseminating their own news is almost by definition propaganda.
yes.
So, great.
Yeah, it is. I mean,
I love when political figures, it's too critical. I'm how dare you scrutinize me? I'm just going to, I'm going to do it myself. Honestly, it is a tactic more political figures on the right are using because, many of them can probably fairly incredibly argue that the coverage they get is so relentlessly negative and so relentlessly biased that they've said to hell with it. Why engage with the mainstream media at all?
Sure,
we'll just
sure.
And we can use social media to go around them.
Exactly.
DeSantis is a very very big
FDR
booster
did it.
Of this approach.
Bernie did it with his fireside chats. I don't have a problem with the idea of politicians speaking directly to the public at all. The idea of who pays for it, I think, is a question, whether or not
well,
you come
it's
at taxpayers.
Nope.
Right. However, my bigger problem with this is that it seems to be emblematic of Eric Adams' character from the jump, which is that he has been a mayor that's known for being out of the nightclub scene, going to every hot party, being in the line at all of the major swanky events in New York City, a mainstay at Cipriani's. You know, he is someone who clearly has an interest in elevating his own public profile through this position, and historically that comes at the consequence of actually delivering meaningfully for the people. Is this just another vanity project for a mayor that seemed to be more interested in his personal brand than actually improving life for New Yorkers?
Mm. Yes. you phrase that as a question, but I think the answer is yes. The subway issue, which has gotten so much attention, clearly not under control yet. I don't know why that is. Both he and Governor Hochul have actually talked a lot about doing something about crime.
Yep.
It's not working. You know, why do you think that is?
I mean, I don't know. I think that there are people who study these things very hard and have longitudinal data, and they could probably tell you about
what the people all disagree on what to do about it, and they have data to marshal in both directions.
I don't believe, my understanding was that there were zero experts or close to zero experts who said that the issue was that we needed to have more police officers standing around at the turnstiles in the subways the way that we have. He's done what he promised to do. I just want to be really clear. Eric Adams delivered on his promises. It is a wall-to-wall police officers in the New York subway system. And yet, crime rates have gone up. I mean, there was a viral video. I don't know if we can pull it up in time for this segment, but there was a viral video going around that everyone was laughing at, New York City subway system. Someone had fallen onto the tracks, and a bunch of Good Samaritans were helping them off. And the police officer, who was there, because there's always a police officer there now in the subway in New York City, was just kind of standing there with a flashlight impotently, like, lighting the scene. And the people around were kind of heckling him because it was so clear how impotent he was when New Yorkers were handling their business and getting the job done and saving this New Yorker on the tracks. So look, I am not, you know, obviously I'm not the crime analyst for New York City. I'm sure there's a whole mix of factors, including ongoing poverty rates, the economic crisis that the poor have not come out of, extreme cost of living issues in New York that are going to lead to higher levels of homelessness and crime. You know, these are the things that have always caused crime since time immemorial. I wouldn't be surprised if that's actually, if it's continuing to happen in a city like New York, where the impacts of economic crises tend to be felt more harshly because it's a more expensive place to live. But what we know for a fact is increasing police funding and staffing more police on the tracks hasn't done the job. Maybe we need another 2 years of even more police funding and paying for more overtime for police officers to stand around and play Pokemon Go on their phones or whatever people are playing these days.
Pokemon Go arrests the people sleeping on the subway.
Well, look, but that's also not the issue. The crime issue and the homelessness issue are not the same issue, and I think too often treating them as though they are is why the actual crime issue isn't getting resolved.
What do you mean? But they're closely correlated. They're closely linked, aren't they?
No, if a homelessness issue is a poverty issue, and sometimes crime is also a poverty issue, but the idea that keeping people from sleeping on the tracks is keeping people from robbing people in the subway, those are not the same cohorts of people. There's a mental illness problem, there's a poverty problem, and then there's this separate crime
problem. My understanding is that a large proportion of the people homeless staying on the subway are experiencing drug issues or mental health issues,
sure,
which overlapping with criminal issues at a very staggering rate. A person not going through mental illness or severe drug addiction just happened
absolutely
to be sleeping on the subway. I don't think that's that common.
But I agree with you. So it's a mental illness problem. It's a drug addiction problem. It's all of these kinds of problems. And I regret to inform everybody that as much as police officers can try their best, and I'm sure there's many lovely people among them, they are not equipped to resolve a mental health crisis that started in the 1970s when we shut down all of our mental health institutions and stopped funding them altogether. And there were problems with those as well. I don't mean to brush that history under the rug.
I think shutting down the mental health institutions was a big mistake. I've said that. I think that was a huge mistake. I don't think leaving these people out in the street or on the subway is the humane thing to do. I know we had a lot of, there used to be a lot of issues with, oh, they're being medicalized or it's like Nazi experiments or something in mental health institutes. I think a lot of that was, frankly, exaggerated.
One flew over the cuckoo's nest.
I love that book as a kid. I absolutely love that book.
Oh, you've read it.
I loved it. It really affected my thinking about these issues, and I read it in high school. Mm. I still love the book. I think it probably wrongly stated what was going on in mental health hospitals.
I think the abuses, there is like this feedback mechanism, right? You start defunding the hospitals, the conditions decline at the hospitals, and the conditions are so bad at the hospitals that people want them shut down, and it's like a chicken and the egg scenario. So look, maybe what you can do is call in to the Eric Adams Story Hour, call-in show, whatever it is, and have a back and forth about what mental health, drug addiction, anti-poverty programs they could spend the money on that is currently going to pay overtime for cops to hold the flashlight while New Yorkers handle their own business. I gotta love New Yorkers.
That's not helping.
I was back in town in New York for the first time in a long time over New Year's, and I was reminded of how wonderful the city is. God, I miss New York.
You're saying that sincerely?
I'm 100% saying it sincerely. New Yorker through and through. I don't care how long I live in this swamp town.
I am a D.C. over New York, absolutely, till the end of time.
All right, Michigan boy, no pride in your home state?
Michigan?
Yeah.
It's too cold there. It's too cold in New York as well. I mean, it's too cold here. It's too cold everywhere.
I want to live
on the equator somewhere.
All right, we'll do the state wars in a later day, in a later segment. We'll have more Rising for you after this. Developing today, Project Veritas now reports they've caught a Pfizer executive on camera admitting to some shady profiteering. We'll let the clip speak for itself.
It sounds like gain of function to me.
I don't know, it's a little bit different. I think it's different. It's like this. It's definitely not gain of function.
It sounds like it is. I mean, it's okay.
No. No, directed evolution is very different.
Yeah. Well, you're not supposed to do gain of function research with the viruses. They recommend not. But you do like these like selected directional mutations to try to see if you can make more potent.
Yeah.
So there is research ongoing about that. I don't know how that's going to work. There might not be any more outbreaks. Just like Jesus Christ.
So this is the latest from Project Veritas, James O'Keefe, who does these undercover video operations where he records people who work for, he's done someone who works at CNN. This is someone who ostensibly works at Pfizer. And the person doesn't know who James O'Keefe is or who the person doing the video is and is, you know, in a friendly conversation and ends up telling us something that we might not have known otherwise or confirms serious concerns about wrongdoing at these various places. There's been a lot on the employees admitting, like, liberal bias at CNN has been a previous one. So I did watch all 10 minutes of what James O'Keefe released on Twitter. I will say what this individual says is fairly alarming, or at least confirms what alarmed people think. So there he talks about, well, we're not doing gain-of-function exactly. We're doing something kind of like that.
Talks about structured evolution.
Talks about manipulating viruses. Talks about, and actually later makes points that you and I have made explicitly about how, well, it's an open door policy between the regulators and Pfizer, and it's really good for us at Pfizer and makes us lots of money. It's bad for like humanity. He explicitly says that. So he says a lot of things that, again, are alarming to people who are concerned about this. The caution I would urge here is James O'Keefe released 10 minutes. It is edited. It's not just like there's no full transcript of this conversation. Mm. And I say this repeatedly, and I know he has a lot of fan. And I'm not saying the work he is doing is not valid or is not useful. I'm saying the opposite of that. I think this is valid, and I think this is useful, and I want to know more about it. But I always have to urge a little bit of caution because he does it. It's not done fully transparently, we don't have the raw footage, we don't have the raw transcript. I don't know what this person thought the arrangement was when he went into this conversation. And Like, if you get under a fraudulent understanding of what a conversation is, if you're lying or exaggerating or misrepresenting yourself in a conversation, what is your guarantee that the other person isn't doing that as well?
Yeah, they're people do puffery and try to make themselves seem more important and exaggerate.
Where they're drinking, making themselves sound more important. So, and this individual, this video dropped last night, I believe. So then I like everyone else, started looking up this individual who's been identified as Jordan Tristan Walker, supposedly a Pfizer director of research and development and strategic operations. So in that video, he said, quote, one of the things Pfizer is exploring is like why we don't just mutate COVID ourselves so we could create preemptively developed new vaccines, right? So we have to do that. If we're going to do that, though, there's a risk of, like, as you could imagine, no one wants to be having a pharma company mutating effing viruses. So I went looking for this individual, and you can find very little evidence of him on social media.
No, now, LinkedIn?
So people have found what they believe is his LinkedIn, and it looks plausible that in the time between this video dropping and now, he deleted his or took out all the other identifying information or the I work at Pfizer stuff. There's not a lot on him. People are saying that's because it's being scrubbed from the internet, which that checks out. So I don't think that's not a conspiracy theory. That looks plausible to me. Mm-hmm. But there isn't a lot of verification that, like, I don't know for certain that this person exists and actually does work at Pfizer. James O'Keefe thinks he does and has presented some evidence that he does. I'm just being totally clear. I'm not saying I'm disputing that evidence. I would just like to see more before I 100% validate the idea that this person is real and works for Pfizer.
But also, can we get to why this information is important and whether or not it's in fact novel? I mean, the things that he is saying, you know, quote, from what I've heard, it's Pfizer scientists are optimizing the COVID mutation process, but they're going slow because everyone is very cautious. Obviously, they don't want to accelerate it too much. I think what they're trying to do is an exploratory thing because you obviously don't want to advertise that you're figuring out future mutations. I mean, this sounds kind of like gain-of-function research, but what do we know about, has Pfizer already admitted to doing gain-of-function research? Is that a new admission, or is what he's saying here that they in fact know that they can't do gain-of-function research, but it would be good, a thing to pursue if you wanted to preemptively come out with vaccines from new variants?
I think there's no doubt that what he's saying, if they're doing that, is super shady. I mean, because he says they're doing one thing and not admitting that they're doing that. So regardless of if you characterize it as gain-of-function or regardless of the legal status, he's saying publicly they're saying we do this,
that we don't privately mutate viruses in order to anticipate new vaccines.
He said privately we are discussing in meetings doing things that the public is against, that we're not admitting to the public we're doing. So what he is saying on face value is definitely newsworthy and bad in my view. The complicating factor is that maybe this is boastful or exaggerated, or he's wrong because he's drinking with a stranger or with someone who thinks he is a friend. And also, I don't know for sure what his role is in the company. He could be exaggerating his role in the company. I don't know for sure that he works there. Those are all the things that I'm less certain about. What he's saying, if, you know, it's a big if true kind of deal, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people will be alarmed. Or at least it's confirming things we're suggesting. He's talking about how, yeah, they can get anything approved because it's easy because they have so much cooperation between lobbyists and regulators, et cetera. He talks about explicitly how this same deal works for weapons manufacturers. That is the same thing, that the people who there are people in the government. It's a revolving door between weapons contractors and government. He's describing things you and I are describing all the time.
Yeah, this was my radar yesterday, all about the new Biden chief of staff, who was a big pharma profiteer for his entire career before he became the COVID czar, and now this. So, yeah, all of that's fair play. I'm just really curious. I mean, if it's true, I guess I'm still trying to understand the big part. Do we not know that Pfizer does... Is it news that Pfizer is doing gain-of-function research? Do we know that they've done it, but they said they stopped in the past? Do we know that it's been happening, but not in the United States, or not at Pfizer, not at a specific facility? Are there bans on gain-of-function research, or is it just a kind of politically...
Well, federally funded gain-of-function research has been halted. So if you're getting grants from the government, you can't do it.
So again,
a debate over what qualifies as gain-of-function.
Right. So
what Rand Paul says qualifies as it... And what Dr. Fauci says qualifies as it are different things.
So I'm just trying to figure out what the there is. Is it that Pfizer is doing something that's like untoward looking because of the implications of that this kind of research could have started the whole pandemic in the first place? Or are they actually breaking the law and doing something that they're forbidden from doing? I mean, we know that gain-of-function research happens.
The there is that, according to this person, behind closed doors, they are having conversations about manipulating COVID to create vaccines, and publicly they're saying they're not doing that.
But look,
regardless of whether it's technically illegal
or not. It's one thing to disclose, to not reveal that information because you're doing something illegal. Mm-hmm. Or you're doing something that's prohibited. It's another thing to not disclose the information because you know it's bad optics and companies aren't under an obligation to tell you everything.
Well, sure, but I think it's a there either way.
Yeah,
I'm
not saying it isn't. I'm just trying to understand what the implications of this is. Is it, oh my gosh, someone needs to go to jail? Mm-hmm. There needs to be an investigation. They're doing dangerous activity that's been prohibited because it could start a pandemic? Or is it a corporation doing what corporations do? Not that insulates them from criticism, but are they doing what they're doing and they keep it private because rightly or wrongly there is a belief that the kind of activity that they're doing is dangerous and would be bad for
audience. But he says they're lying about what they're doing. So that's bad whether it is technically illegal
or
not.
Well, this is where the puffery comes in. Are you lying or are you just not disclosing facts about how a company operates? Are you misrepresenting what you're doing, or are you just choosing not to tell the world because there's no obligation for you to do so?
But that could itself be bad. You could argue they should be disclosing what they're actually doing because, given the generous funding by the government that helps pay for their research, that we, the taxpayers, the citizens, deserve to know,
said,
given this tremendous overlap.
You said that there's a ban on government-funded gain-of-function research. So if it's actually what they're doing is improper and illegal, then that's obviously newsworthy, but if it's not because it wasn't actually government funded, I don't know. I think it's
newsworthy because it's improper. What he is saying is that they're misleading the public about what they do behind closed doors. That was what this person alleged. But this person could be wrong. This person could be not an employee of Pfizer. This person is there. That's where all of my questions are. Which is typically where my questions are with James O'Keefe type stuff.
I mean, the way he put it, he said it wasn't gain of function research. It sounds like I'm not a scientist, so the things that sound similar to me may or not be like actually that similar. He said something about like structured evolution. Does that mean you're just kind of, you know, replicating the virus and allowing it to mutate in its natural way, as opposed to doing genetic modification on the virus? And are there different danger levels from doing one versus another?
I'd like to know that. We would need more information, and this is my frustration with this format. We would need, if it was an article, or if I could read an entire transcript of what they said, or if it was in an article to describe, here's how we met this individual. Here's how, are they aware? With James O'Keefe, they're usually not. Are they aware?
How many cocktails have they had tonight?
These are all very relevant facts. What is this person's job? How high up does he work? They dropped the video. They characterize it. He has that Dr. Malone gives some commentary in part of the video, who's a very, very anti-vaccine voice. Mm. And then later there's like additional tweets like, oh yeah, here's the screenshot of who this person is or something. Okay, I need more to verify, but
Project Verify. That's what
again, I'm not saying because it's bad or it shouldn't be listened to. People accuse me of like having some beef with James O'Keefe or something. I'm not saying I think this could be valuable. I want to know more.
Yeah.
Want to know more.
Fair enough.
We have reached out to Pfizer for comment and we'll keep you updated if they get back to us, and we'll have more Rising right after this.
As we discussed on the show yesterday, Twitter CEO Elon Musk reportedly caved to pressure from the Indian government to remove the BBC documentary critical of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, which the Indian government denounced as hostile propaganda and anti-India garbage.
One Twitter user tweeted, "What's going on, Elon Musk? Twitter seems to have gone from freedom of speech, not freedom of reach, to outright censorship in no time at all. Hashtag politics ruins everything." To which Musk responded, "First I've heard. It is not possible for me to fix every aspect of Twitter worldwide overnight while still running Tesla and SpaceX, among other things."
I mean, it's obviously true. I mean, you can't expect him to see every decision that's been made at the app. But on some level, he's kind of brought this kind of criticism on himself by inserting himself so publicly into the decision-making process for high-profile Twitter users. So when he is openly saying, I'm making decisions about whether or not Alex Jones can stay on the app based on my personal tragedy and experience with a lost child and Alex Jones being kicked off because of the Sandy Hook massacre lies, you know, we do expect then to turn to Elon Musk, the man, as the person from whom all of these decisions are coming from.
Yeah, I completely understand why people treat Elon Musk as if everything that happens at Twitter, he has his direct hand in. He has encouraged that impression
yes.
by responding to people, making requests of Twitter.
Yeah, I'll take care of it.
Constantly. So I 100% get why people think that. That is an impression he's given. That said, that is extremely plausible to me, him having no idea about this,
sure.
this being signed off on by someone else, because, as I said when we discussed this earlier, it is routine behavior, for better or for worse, for social media companies or tech companies to unfortunately do what repressive governments want in order to stay active in those countries. This has been true. This has characterized Google's relationship with China, and it happens over and over again. And it, look, it is a bad thing. It is bad that authoritarian governments make these requests of social media in the same way that I am very against a lot of requests that have been made by our own government of tech companies.
Sure.
And I don't think you can entirely necessarily blame the tech executives if the alternative is that company can't operate in that country at all.
Sure.
That is a decision to like weigh very carefully whether it is better to have a limited and censored version of the platform in the country or no version at all.
Okay, but now that I'm thinking about this, let's interrogate this Elon must not have known a little bit further. We're in the middle of a Twitter files journalistic extravaganza where he is granting unprecedented transparency into the goings-on of this company. And one of the key arguments that is being made is that previous owners of Twitter have been susceptible to pressure campaigns from the government, from the press, from some unholy union of a government and the press, et cetera. That being the case and such a public focus of everything that's going on in the media right now and the criticism of Elon Musk and the app, a request comes in from one of the most populous, powerful, biggest landmass nations on the planet to censor a BBC documentary, again, a documentary from a Western ally like the UK. And we don't think that that wasn't flagged and run by, if not Elon Musk, then someone very senior before a decision was made.
What we've learned is that the previous CEO of Twitter had very little input in
right, but
decisions.
Elon Musk, his whole brand is that he's not the previous CEO of Twitter.
Well, you can criticize him and you can say he should have been aware of this and not done this, but he's saying he didn't know this would happen, which maybe suggests he wouldn't have done this or will reverse it. Glenn Greenwald, by the way, has responded to this whole ordeal, tweeting, quote, and I thought this was very perceptive, the ability of India to force Twitter and YouTube to ban a documentary upon threat of blocking the platform from the country is a huge threat, but it's happening everywhere. Rumble is blocked in France because it refuses to censor RT. Brazil is about to be blocked on, Brazil is about to block Telegram. And, you know, Glenn goes on to say that it would take a united front from, you know, all of the tech companies to say we're not going to do this kind of thing. But then you get like China is totally going to not blink. They'll say, okay, then you can't operate here.
Yeah.
And look, I think it's worth having a discussion about whether that's what we want or not, because I think there are good arguments on both sides. I think there is an argument for don't negotiate with terrorists, don't negotiate with repressive governments. If they say they want this, you say, no, sorry. And then you deprive them of that, and then theoretically, hopefully, the people get mad and they demand that the repressive government stop being so repressive and you know ease back those demands. That's one theory of social change. Another would be is you go along with it, you give the country some access, the people have that access, and then because the censorship isn't perfect, they are still able to use the platforms to like get around it and look at certain things
tough.
And learn more. That's hard.
It's for sure a tough decision. But look, you said a little bit earlier that Elon Musk is, you know, obviously distinguishing himself from previous ownership, and perhaps his response to that tweet indicates that he would have done things differently if given the chance, and certainly differently than previous ownership. One interesting wrinkle in this story is that Ken Klippenson posted the Intercept article about Elon Musk caving to pressure to suppress this BBC doc, and apparently previous owner of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, liked Kim Klippenstein's tweet. The implication being that he also sees some problem with Elon Musk's behavior here, that perhaps Jack is frustrated with being the one that's, you know, presented with, you know, his regime at least is being presented as the one where all the bad things happen and all the censorship happened. And Elon Musk is the kind of the good guy that's bringing light to the darkness. I mean, what do you take from the idea that Jack would have liked a tweet like this, an article criticizing Elon Musk's free speech consistency on the app?
Well, I'm sure he doesn't like that this demand was complied with, just as I don't like it either. Just I don't like when any of these demands are complied with. But he should know better, and likely does, that this is ends up being very difficult in the real world.
So you think that Jack liking the tweet is just saying, oh, I'm solidary with Elon, and it's hard out there for a pimp.
No. He's expressed frustration with Elon at various points. He stuck up for Yoel Roth, that content moderator, I think probably correctly, as we then came to learn more about how decisions were made vis-a-vis subsequent Twitter files releases. I, as well, changed my thinking and started to blame more the pressure was so heavy, was so unbelievable and insurmountable. I very much understand why they eventually were worn down and thought they had to go along with it. Look, these are really difficult. It's difficult questions. It's not easy. You shouldn't pretend it's easy. You can't just say, no, we're not going to do this. Well, then there's Twitter in India.
You shouldn't pretend it's easy, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact
Twitter will only operate in, like, Switzerland or so, whatever the least obtrusive government is.
Sure, I don't want to pretend it's easy, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that the reason that it is being presented as an easy decision is because Elon Musk himself kind of white-knighted this and swooped in and said, hey, I'm going to take over Twitter and solve all these problems. And all I'm going to do, I'm just going to let people back on the site. The problem was freedom. I'm going to give freedom. Comedy is free now. We can do all these things. And immediately he started running into the real substantive issues that everyone has had to deal with. He says comedy is allowed on the app again. Okay, he immediately had to reverse his policy that allowed everybody to change their handles and impersonate other people, including Elon Musk. He says you can tweet whatever you want. Okay, but not if you're tweeting about the location of my private jet. Okay, you can come back on the app. My friends, or maybe they're not his friends, I don't know, people that he has this relationships with, like Kanye West. Oh, but now you have to go back off the app, and not necessarily because you violated the terms, but because it's awkward that I've been defending you and you just posted a weird swastika Star of David hybrid. You know, he put himself in the position of saying, hey, I'm the Superman who's going to save this app, and has been dealing with nothing but crisis after crisis after crisis. So to the extent that people are asking him to come up with easy, bold solutions to difficult problems, I do think he has to take a look in the mirror.
That's true. It's very complicated. It's even more complicated than Elon Musk might have thought it was at the start of this takeover. I totally agree with that. And because it's important for him to run those other companies as well, should maybe put a CEO in charge.
Yeah, what happened to that? He said he was going to step down.
We're still waiting.
There was a poll.
I haven't gotten the call yet. I don't know about you.
I don't want the job.
Unless, I don't think we have time for it.
Unless the salary is somewhere close to that $44 billion.
Oh, you're going to poach Brianna from my show. Don't do it. Don't do it. That wraps us up for this week. Tomorrow you can catch the Best of Rising, where we air all of the week's highlights. We had some real good ones this week.
Yeah, it was a solid week. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe so you don't miss any content. And for those of you who like to listen while on the go, we are now available anywhere you listen to podcasts. I had someone tweet at me the other day, I wish this were a podcast. And I said, guess what, King? It is. Good news. So be sure to check that out. We're also available on Roku and other streaming services. So catch us there as well.
Good news to all you kings out there. Take care.
Right. Take care.